Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Actually,
here's John Williams.
Worried about a big thought today. It's 107. This is John. That is that your devices are listening and sometimes laughing, and they shouldn't be.
Lord,
don't you hate it when people laugh at you and you didn't think you said something funny? It's 107. This is the John Williams Show on WGN Radio. We're here weekdays until 3, starting at 1, and on Saturdays, you can hear my show from 10 a.m. till noon on all social media. I'm WGN King John. I'm not king yet. I want to be. The paperwork is tied up in Cook County. That's kind of funny. Hey, Elif, do you think it's funny when I say the paperwork is tied up at Cook County?
I'm sorry, John. I haven't heard anything funny yet.
Ha, ha, ha.
All right, so here's the controversy today. Incidentally, in the 1 o'clock hour, in this hour, we'll also be visiting with a lady from the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I want to talk about what happened to the $100 million that were supposed to go to the University of Chicago. The family that gave it said, now we want our money back, $100 million. You know what? If you have $100 million, you shouldn't be giving it to the University of Chicago anyway. I want to have this conversation with somebody who's in the business of philanthropy. If you have $100 million... And first of all, I'm not sure that you should, but if you do, what do you think of giving $100 million of it to the University of Illinois or to Harvard or to Stanford or to the University of Chicago? And then they can have a global research center on peace or something fabulous like that. And there'll be big buildings and computers and fancy teachers and all
that. And your name will probably be on the building.
I think that's a lot of it. I think that's a lot of it. You know, you gave me $100 million, I swear to God I would do this. I would go to every single public school in Chicago. I might even go to the parochial schools. And you go up to that principal and you say, what do you need? I promise you they have a list. They have a list right now. And it's not fancy stuff. Maybe for some of them it is. But for a lot of them it's going to be, boy, I would love to have a full-time art teacher. I would love to have a better after or preschool program. We could use new computers. Stuff like that. And you could walk into those schools and problem solve, problem solve, problem solve. Real, you know, feet on the ground, practical,
but
specific problems solved.
That might be a temporary solution to an ongoing problem. So although it might solve that year's issue,
Yeah. It's
going to just get bad again. So you have to try to put things in motion that are going to better it for the future.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
$100 million to the University of Chicago, though. And, you know, hey, we all love our U of C. I mean, Chicago's on the map for a good reason because of that. It's one of the great things about Chicago is the University of Chicago. I ain't hating on the U of C, but I've just never understood that impulse. Like, maybe $100 million is too much to imagine, but if you had, say, $1 million and you could give 100 schools $10,000 each, wouldn't you do that? Wouldn't that really feel substantial and different? And even if it's a Band-Aid, even if for only the next couple of years, then they've got a real good math program at that school or a music department. Think of all of the schools in Chicago that would benefit if the kids all had good orchestra instruments or band instruments. And instead of hoping for athletics or having nothing to do, they had richer arts programs. I would be on board for that. We'll talk about this a little after 1:30, including the woman who won. You see the lady that won the lottery? $559 million in the lottery she wins. And she's already given away $249,000 of it, which I don't think is a lot. But that's okay. She's got $559. She has, right? $559 million. That is half a billion dollars. She should give away 80% of that, her life would be so much easier. But anyway, here's the controversy about that. She doesn't want anybody to know who she is. Her attorneys and foundation are doing this. But you know, when you buy the ticket, they say, we can use you as for promotional purposes. If you win, we get to tell people who you are. Congratulations to Steve Bertrand. He just won $559 million. That's part of the deal. I think that's a lousy deal. I think that's a lousy deal for the winners. At the end of the day, the lottery is a way to make money because you sell tickets. That's all. I'm not working for you. I shouldn't have to do anything other than be one of the fools that gave you the money, and then you guys get to keep a lot of it, and you pay some of it off. That's how a lottery works.
But they want to show that it's the common Joe. Look, it's just like you, the guy down the block, the girl who's working hard, raising her kids.
Yeah.
They want to tell the story so that more people feel like they can win.
I guess. I think ill befalls the mega winners, though. And right. I don't blame them for wanting to be anonymous. We'll get into that after 1:30. Let's go back to the fact, though, that Alexa... Is it Alexa or Siri? Is it Alexa or Siri?
Alexa.
Alexa is listening in. And I guess Alexa is accidentally interpreting something that she hears as the people saying, "Alexa, laugh." And so, randomly, across households in America, this is what they're hearing. Alexa just laughs. Some people say not only is that unfortunate, but that it sounds like Hillary Clinton when Hillary Clinton would laugh.
It does.
Hit it. It does.
I just spit. That was so funny.
It does sound like Hillary's laugh. Well, at least it doesn't sound like Frances McDormand when she was at the Oscars. Here's Frances. That's not a good laugh. I would definitely want my money back if I had the horsey laugh as opposed to the Hillary laugh. Love me some Frances McDormand, don't get me wrong, but that was not a good laugh. That was not a good laugh. So I guess the fix is that you now say to Alexa, "Alexa, can you laugh?" And why would you want Alexa to laugh unless you maybe told a joke and then, why do you want a machine to laugh? I don't understand that.
You could be really lonely and you need to feel the presence of somebody else there.
Right, I guess. And you also want that presence to sort of stroke your ego and you're funny. Because you could have Alexa read you the temperature. You could say, "Alexa, what's the temperature in Chicago?" And then she'll tell you, "Alexa, play WGN." By the way, what happens if I do this right now? "Alexa, laugh." Do you think that just made it laugh and machines across our radio?
Yeah,
we should have people call in or text in and tell us.
If I want to hear what, because the versions that I heard on TV today were different laughs anyway, right? I guess it depends on exactly how your Alexa is set up, but for some people the laugh sounded a little like Hillary, and for some it sounded, just like an animated laugh or a machine laugh.
Yeah, I thought we were supposed to avoid saying the name because it does trigger the device.
Yeah, someone just texted in, "Don't say Alexa."
Well,
just call it the Echo.
the A thing. No, I can't say that. Okay, so if you want to just give us a call, 312-981-7200, I'd like to hear what yours sounds like. If in fact, that's happening for you. If when I say, "Alexa, laugh," or "Alexa, can you laugh?" Is your machine really laughing right now?
Yes.
Well, it's worse things could happen, right? It could be worse. It could be Hillary. Can we hear Hillary one more time? This is Hillary Clinton when she laughed. Poor Hillary. Poor Hillary. And then this is Alexa. So you have Hillary in your head. This is Alexa laughing. Yeah, boy, it does sound a lot like
her. I don't hear it.
You don't?
No.
Steve, do you think that sounds like Hillary Clinton when Alexa laughs?
Yes.
I think it kind of sounds like...
some sort of machine doing it?
It kind of sounds like your Siri doing it.
Oh, you think that sounds like Elif? Elif, can you laugh for us?
I'm sorry, John, but I haven't heard anything funny yet.
She's not.
I'll say the world.
It's 1:16 now on WGM. So 312-981-7200 if you want to share with us your, what I'll need you to do, I guess, is be on the phone with the radio on, and I'll say that. I want to hear your device respond in the way that I guess that these things are. I also have in front of me, let's do this. Let's take the break first. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Call me and we'll do this experiment on WGN. You know, maybe we shouldn't do this little experiment because of what Dean wants to say. Dean, you're on WGN. Hi, how are you?
Please stop.
Yeah, what happened?
Every time you say my echo's name, yeah, she silences and listens to anything else that's going on in the background. So whether I'm yelling at my dog or talking to a client or whatever, she stops and does whatever I'm in and whatever I'm asking. So please stop, because then I yell at her to stop, and then she turns off, and then I have to tell her to turn back on to John Williams' show. And as soon as I have you back on, you'd say your name again. She would silence and listen again.
Oh, no. Oh,
I'm
no.
I'm just letting you know, everybody's echo machine is turning silent when you say your name.
Yeah.
And listening to whatever is being done in the background.
Oh, this is a bad idea. I want to get people to listen.
And then she starts answering me, and if I yell at her to stop, she stops. And then I have to say, Echo,
start it all over again.
Put on WGN again. It would come back on.
I must say.
And the same process. You would say it again, and she would silence.
The interface of these technologies is much more complicated than it used to be. You know, when I was a kid, you turn on the radio and there'd be radio. It wasn't, you know, you weren't talking to
it. I don't even have a radio in my house anymore, so I'm listening to you solely on my Echo device.
Isn't that funny? Well, I'm glad you do that. Hey, listen, I'm going to stop doing it, Dean. Thank you for the call.
Please do. Thanks, John.
Have a good day. Appreciate you listening. You listen, I'll try and make it easier for you.
Someone just called in or texted in and said that you can make Alexa fart, too. I just said the name again.
Oh, no. You say, Alexa, do that.
Don't
and
say
Alexa
the name.
Will.
That was an accident.
I know. You tell your device to do that, and she'll do that? Oh, no.
I have audio for you if
now,
you'd like.
Now, that would make me laugh.
Ready?
I don't know that I want to hear what you're about
to play.
I'm
pretty sure I'm not.
Yeah.
I've pre-screened it.
I did not.
All right.
Who's this Elif?
Yeah, I know. She's going all rogue on us here.
You guys just don't know me.
All right, let me try a joke. Let me see if I can get my Elif to laugh. Elif. Elif. Grasshopper. No. Elif. Grasshopper hops into a bar. Bartender says, "Hey, fella, we've got a drink named after you." And the grasshopper says, "You've got a drink named Irving?"
I'm sorry, John, but I haven't heard anything funny yet.
All right. Stuck with that. You've got a drink named Irving? Isn't that fun? You've got a drink named Irving.
I don't get it.
It's one of my favorite jokes. I love that joke.
Steve, do you get it?
Of course he does.
Well, yeah.
It's a funny joke.
Why, is there a drink named Hopper?
I know. Never mind. By the way, this texter from yesterday's show, you know, when I was talking about how I'm sorry that you can't use currency in some stores now, it's been a rant of mine that I've been poisting on you for the last couple of days. John, this guy says, I am constantly amazed. This listener works at Apple. John, I am constantly amazed at the number of customers who come into the Apple store and ask if we accept cash. They sound embarrassed when they ask, almost as embarrassed as those who sheepishly admit that they still use AOL for their email. I forget who it was, but I was giving somebody grief the other day for what his service provider was. And it was like AOL. It was one of those... like
Hotmail, too? Who has a Hotmail account?
Ameritech.net or something like that. You go, you've got to be kidding me. And I don't understand why we criticize. He goes, well, why do I need to change it away from AOL? It still works. I still get my email.
He probably has a discount for being such a loyal customer.
I know. He was there 12 years ago or whatever it was. John, I'm amazed at the number of customers that come in to Apple to ask if we accept cash. Even funnier, at least once a day, a customer at the Apple Old Orchard asked me if we accept Apple Pay. To be honest with you, I don't know the answer to that question, but that's from one of our listeners who works at an Apple store.
I'm going to say they accept Apple Pay.
I suppose so. But he didn't answer the question, do they accept cash? And I assume they do.
They do.
But they don't. Well, that was your story,
yeah.
Violetta.
Whenever I go into an Apple store, they look at me like I'm crazy. I feel like they're judging me for paying cash.
Yeah, it's really analog. And don't you realize this is a digital store, lady?
Yeah.
All right. I have... fell upon a really interesting website the other day, philanthropy.com. Philanthropy.com is the magazine that sort of chronicles philanthropy, charitable giving. They like to think of themselves as the Wall Street Journal of charities. It's really interesting, the things they post in there, like if you are a school or a charity, how can you get more donations? Who's giving money these days? Who are the top charitable givers in the United States? They have a top 50 list. Three of them are from Illinois. I don't know who they are, but I'm also interested in what they think about this story over at the University of Chicago that broke this week, and that is this family, the Pearsons, had decided to give $100 million to the U of C. They wanted them to create the Pearson Institute for the Study and Resolution of Global Conflicts. Who wouldn't be for that, right? The resolution of global conflicts. And my only problem with that is it's sort of like the war on terror or poverty. I don't think you can ever win. And so you've got this thing, and it really doesn't accomplish much. And I think $100 million to even that lofty a goal is not money well spent. Now, maybe they'll persuade me otherwise. But we'll talk a little bit about who's giving how much and what they know about this story after the news. The news is next on WGN. Steve, I feel a little bad. I told my favorite joke of all time on the radio a couple of minutes ago, and Violetta said she didn't get it.
She came in here and asked me to explain it to her.
And I don't want you to feel bad or feel dumb, Violetta, because you don't get what I thought was the funniest joke ever. If I have to explain the joke, then it's evidently not funny. But it shouldn't be that complicated. The joke is, a grasshopper hops into a bar. The bartender says, "Hey, little fella, we've got a drink named after you." And the grasshopper says, "You've got a drink named Irving?" That's a good joke. How is it that you're not laughing at
that? Violetta's laughing at it now that she understands it.
Right. And you definitely didn't make me feel bad. Steve made me feel bad.
How did I make you feel bad?
He barely wanted to answer the question. I'm like, hey, I just want to get the joke. What is it?
You didn't notice, but I was doing a newscast when you were asking.
You didn't know.
And then he made fun of my sweater.
You didn't know that there's a drink called Grasshopper?
No, I did not know that was a drink.
It's definitely your grandparents' drink.
We
right?
helped her understand it by saying it's a McShake with cream de mint.
That's really what it is. Yeah. It's a McShake with booze. That's a cream de mint.
And Shamrock Shake, guys.
There you go. Yeah.
And Shamrock Shake.
I don't know who drinks those anymore. Yeah, that joke does feel very dated, right? So if you're...
Yeah, I'm going to walk into a speakeasy tonight and say, hey, can I get a grasshopper drink, please?
Okay, so far to this week topics. Not being able to use dollars.
Right, I know.
Grasshoppers.
I know, and really, grasshopper
but you know
does
what?
Date
it is,
the show.
It is my fault, though, for not understanding the joke, because you should know it has something to do with the name.
Right.
Because he goes, oh, my name's Irving.
It is kind of self-explanatory, but the bottom line...
But it's
line,
just maybe not that funny.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry, John, but I haven't heard anything funny yet.
Yeah, we know. It's 1:37. Hey, so listen to this. We've been talking this week just a little bit about, now for some expert commentary, the story that I'm reading from the Chicago Sun-Times, Payback Time. Family sues University of Chicago to recoup nearly $23 million they've given the school, claiming it mismanaged the Pearson Institute. Pearsons are evidently some very successful and very generous people. I'm sure they're swell folks. And they said, let's give $100 million to the University of Chicago to create, with their name on it, a study and resolution organization for global conflicts. That's a good idea. And look, if the Gates can wipe out disease in third world countries, you know, maybe somebody could be just as ambitious and make the world a safer or better place. I presume that's the idea. I've said earlier, and I'll just state it again for the record, that I would prefer them to spend the money more locally and more specifically, more, you know, like on teachers or on art supplies or on school lunches or on, I don't know, something that gets in the hands of somebody and makes an actual factual difference.
You want to see the instant impact.
I kind of do, and I get your criticism of that, that's a Band-Aid approach. But I don't think that hiring art and music teachers for schools for 10 years is a Band-Aid. You know, kids will go through schools having better lives and come out richer as a result, just as a for instance.
But the world will not be better for them.
I don't think the world's going to be better for this institute either. That's my problem. Okay, so here's Stacey Palmer. Stacey is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and she joins us on WGN Radio. Hi, Stacey. You're on WGN. How are you?
Great to join you.
So jump into this conversation. What do you think of what we've said so far?
You know, this is the big debate in philanthropy is what money can do the most good and how do we figure that out and how do you channel all these different passions that people who are very rich and people who are just middle class and people who are poor, how do we all decide how much of our giving is going to good causes, what mm-hmm. causes, how much? And it's a tricky, tricky question, but one of the things we certainly have seen is that colleges have been extraordinarily successful in raising these very big gifts from a lot of wealthy people. So I think we're going to keep seeing that trend happening. So that means there could also be more of these disputes over how should the money be used and it really being used as the donors wanted.
I hate that I sound, you know, who am I to judge somebody else's philanthropy? You know, I ain't giving anybody $100 million. But if they ask for my advice, I would just tell them, no, we're not going to make you, you're not going to. The University of Chicago isn't going to come up with the key for world peace, but we could sure make specific lives better. I mean, is there a certain logic to what I'm saying? And I wonder what the philanthropic community thinks about that.
Yeah, I think people don't see it as an either or, that wealthy people often give a significant sum to causes like you're talking about. They just don't necessarily get as much publicity for giving to the food bank or, you know, doing some of those kinds of local giving. You know, but the other problem is we don't really have an easy way to say, here's what $50 million to good cause X would do. If you gave $50 million to your really small local charity, it probably doesn't have the way to dispose that. So colleges have ways of thinking about that. And what some people in philanthropy are trying to do is figure out how do we package these ideas for social change in a better way so that they can attract $100 million, $200 million. So you see some of that in efforts to improve the school. For example, there are lots of donors who are giving really big gifts to help improve local schools. In Los Angeles, there's a tremendous effort that has really helped improve the schools, and it's a couple that's just invested in making sure that their money is going to what works and what makes a difference. So, you know, as we see more of those role models, perhaps more wealthy people will follow that.
Yeah. I can imagine that's daunting, too. You know, I know this sounds ridiculous, but my idea is you just get a wheelbarrow of money and you just start knocking on the doors of schools and ask the principal, what do you need? And then you just give them the money and then they go buy it. Hopefully they don't steal it. Hopefully they spend it wisely. I'm imagining now all the complications with my idea. But, you know, Chance the Rapper here in Chicago has been chastising the city fathers for not spending enough money or spending it wisely. And he's putting some of his own money where his mouth is, giving it directly to the schools, you know?
Yeah, and that's what there's a terrific charity called Donors Choose that you may know about that allows people to give money directly to school teachers who say, you know, my classroom doesn't have any crayons, and you can give them crayons, you can give them all kinds of things, no matter what your means are. And it has raised $1 billion for schools.
Really?
By lots of people contributing. So that's a terrific way to get people to sort of, and Stephen Colbert is one of their big supporters, and he's helped both give a lot of money and raise. So there are big dollars, but there are all small kinds of contributions that all of us can make. And you can follow the progress of what the students are doing with whatever gift you
really
give. So it's a pretty terrific charity. So
teachers
there
choose.
Are efforts.
Yeah.
Donors choose.
There are
donors choose. And I think your listeners who hear about those kinds of efforts and go check out that website will probably really want to help people. And you know, you get to get involved and choose whatever part of the country you want to be involved in. It could be local, or you could say, hey, I want to help somebody across the country.
Do you have any advice or wisdom on I could buy a cow or a sheep or a goat for a village or a family in some far-flung part of the world where that would actually improve the quality of their life? Do they really get the animal, and does it really make a difference? Do you think that's a good use of my, you know, $25 a month or whatever it is?
Yeah, there have been studies that look at things like that to see, you know, when you're buying the livestock or doing those kinds of things and giving them to families, that's what helps allow them to have a livelihood. And so it's really not about just giving them the animal. It's really about saying, how do they build a business that they, in their economy, that they can use to grow. And the studies have shown that it works, but it, there's a new thought in philanthropy about helping people in very poor parts of the world to say, really, the smartest thing to do is just give them cash. So there are these efforts that are just give people cash directly, none of the intervention of a charity, not saying, you know, we're going to go send community aid workers in to help you. We're just going to give you cash and see what you do with it. And the results have been phenomenal. It's a lot more efficient way to do it. And, you know, they're doing these studies that are proving it's working. And now there's an experiment in one of the Houston suburbs after the flooding. Most of this work has been done in Africa, but now they're trying it to see how it works in the United States. So that could really revolutionize how giving works.
Is that microloans or is it outright cash grants?
It's outright cash. Huh. It says, you know, here's $1,000, do with it what you will.
Wow, wow.
And, you know, there was the fear that people might not use it to advance. You know, what would they use it for? Would, you know, and it turns out that people use it for all kinds of smart things, either to make their house more secure or to feed their family in various ways, but mostly to build small businesses. And that's what helps them get a sustainable lifestyle. But, you know, I think we forget what are some of the obstacles to people doing well in society.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, see, and that goes back.
Cash makes a difference.
That goes back to my thought about the $100 million going to the University of Chicago, which, by the way, also already has $100 million. And the University of Illinois does, and Stanford does, and Harvard does, and a lot of them do. And so you think, gosh, but for some people, it's like the president said, you know, you give folks $1,000, it'll change their life. I don't want to get into that conversation, but I mean, a small amount of money can mean a lot to a lot of people. And if you have that much money, it just seems to me you could be so impactful to so many people. You said to me on and off the air, I guess now, right, Stacey, that it's not a zero-sum game, that
exactly
just because you take it, all right, so then don't fund a global institute at the University of Chicago. It doesn't mean that the money's going to fall into the hands of all of these people. So I hear you on that. Has your magazine or the philanthropic community generally been following this University of Chicago story?
Yes, everybody's watching it. Lawsuits involving donors are very, very rare. Colleges don't want to get into tangles, at least publicly or in court, with the people who support them, because obviously that's going to cause other donors to raise questions and say, should I give to this institution? So clearly something went very wrong. It's hard to tell which side, you know, where the problem is or whether it's really on the part of both of them. But clearly, you know, the university felt that it had to get to this point where it had to say, you know, these are the things that we think are really important for to preserve our academic independence, and donors, you don't get to have control over the money that you have handed over, and you got a tax deduction.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
So once you make a charitable gift,
right,
you need to trust the institution to do the right thing, but clearly the donors didn't feel that way, and there was some kind of a gift contract that they wrote up, and they feel like the terms of that were violated. So it's a pretty sticky situation.
I guess so. Well, an attorney was on this radio station this week, and she said, Karen Conti said, if I recall correctly, if I give you a watch as a gift, that's your watch, and I may change my mind about that gift later, but it doesn't mean I get to get it back. Maybe the contract language in this case, you know, allows them to do so, but is it generally understood in the philanthropic community that once you give the gift, even if the university isn't spending the money the way you wish they would, you don't really get to or should not recall that gift, right?
Right. And, you know, there are legal questions involved here. It's not even just sort of an ethical you should or you shouldn't, but what does the law say about what you're able to do? And part of that key part is that the donors would have given the money over and gotten a tax deduction. So, you know, that means that you and I help subsidize that gift in a way. And so that's why it's in the charity's hands, not in the donor's hands. So that's what makes it even trickier.
Hey, does the new tax code change how people are giving these days?
We expect that it will. Charities are very nervous that giving is going to decrease. And where it's expected to hit the hardest is probably among middle-class donors who aren't really going to get the tax breaks that they used to get. And so that means middle-class donors tend to give the most to local charities. So colleges like the University of Chicago are still going to do really well, but local charities are very nervous that they may not be able to get the gifts that they once got. So they're trying to make sure donors remember that it's not just about the tax break, but about the good that you can do with those dollars.
Yeah. I suppose they knew that when they wrote the tax bill, that what did we do? We doubled the exemption, so fewer people are going to itemize, and therefore the middle-class Americans, somebody making $100,000 a year, they might not itemize, and therefore they're not going to save those receipts, and they're not going to be so willing to give, right?
Right. I mean, just 5% of Americans are expected to itemize under the new tax code. So that means that those are the only people who have access to the charitable deduction. Now, some people might just choose to give less, but some people could choose not to give at all because they were giving for tax reasons. But certainly, it's more expensive to give if you don't get a tax deduction.
Yeah, that's true. Speaking of subsidizing things, but you're right, John. People give maybe because they're charitable. That's the idea, not because it's a write-off. But it does grease the skids a little bit, doesn't it? It makes it easier too if 30% of what you give, you get to write off your taxes, right?
And that might mean you give more. So, you know, if it only costs you 70 cents on a dollar to give, you probably stretched a little bit more. So I don't think people will stop giving, but they may look at their budgets a little differently.
I got a couple calls and questions from listeners. Do you have just one more minute for us?
Absolutely.
Okay. Stacey Palmer is on a phone line. She's the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. So our listener was just wondering, she said, what about the billionaires in this country? Specifically, she was wondering about Donald Trump's philanthropy. But just talk about the billionaires. Are they a generous lot in this country?
One of the things that we look at every year is the people who give the most. And so we rank the 50 donors who have given the most. And many of them are not even rich enough to be on the Forbes 400 list. So it tells you something that at least 150 of the people who are on that list every year, we're just not seeing very much giving by them. Now, they may be giving quietly, and nobody's required to publicize this, but it's always been striking to us that the vast majority of America's wealthiest really don't show up in any public displays of giving, and they haven't signed the giving pledge, which says I'm going to commit at least half of my wealth. So we're not seeing a lot of generosity publicly among those people. So there are real questions. It's certainly people who are less affluent than that who are very generous, and many of them give multiple times.
Well, who are the stars? Is it Ted Turner? Is it Bill Gates? Is it, who are the celebrated great givers in this country?
Bill Gates and Melinda are usually at the top, and they've been very generous. So is Warren Buffett, because he committed a good chunk of his fortune to their foundation and to his kids' foundations. Michael Bloomberg is usually on the list every year very generously. And then we're seeing a lot of the young technology wealth giving. So Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, Sheryl Sandberg, those kinds of folks are appearing very regularly and giving a lot of money every single year.
We are out of time. Your website's very interesting. I don't know that I'm going to subscribe to the magazine. Maybe folks I know obviously do and will, but I would suggest that you at least click through philanthropy.com. The Chronicle of Philanthropy is edited by Stacey Palmer. Stacey, we'll visit again. I appreciate your time today.
Perfect. It was a pleasure.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Bobcat.
Here's John Williams.
It's 2:08. We're in the Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue all the way till 3. Saturday, we're here from 10 a.m. till noon.
Lord have mercy.
And don't forget that we record a podcast on Thursdays called The Mincing Rascals. It's a round table with some of our friends from the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorn, Scott Stannis, Kristen McQuarrie, Steve Bertrand, and I. Elif produces it, and a guy named Ben Cortez here at WGN Radio helps us engineer it each week. It's a roundtable of local, state, and national news. You can imagine what we're talking about these days, the race for governor, the controversy at the county board, the controversy at the assessor's office, and Donald Trump news, which, you know, just dominates too much of people's conversation. In fact, I told the Mincing Rascals today, and you'll hear this later in the podcast, we usually post it around 5 on Thursdays, that I thought Fox News had the appropriate angle compared to, say, CNN. At one point this morning, I opened up my computer and was clicking around, and CNN was all over the Stormy Daniels story. They love them some Stormy Daniels. Fox News had nothing about it. Even as you'd scroll down, recommended stories, opinions, politics news, entertainment news, Fox had nothing on it. So then I used their search bar and I typed in Stormy. And a day earlier, they'd had a couple of stories about it. But it wasn't getting the play that it was everywhere else. Now, that's since changed. You know, they're always updating websites. But I just thought it was sort of telltale that at that time, Fox didn't seem to be too interested in pursuing these allegations against the president. And CNN was loving it, loving it, loving it. Right now, they're talking more about trade, Sarah Sanders, stuff like that. You know, the news cycles evolve. But Fox didn't want to have much to say about it, and CNN sure did. Of the two, I think CNN is overplaying the story. You might say Fox isn't serving its listeners or viewers well by underplaying the story, but I think who's worse? I think CNN is. I still fail to see how super important this story is. I'm reading the stories. I'm no fan of this president. I understand why it's. And Eric Zorn said this. He said, here's why this story matters. Because if the $130,000 paid to her was paid to her to keep her from talking just before the election, then that's essentially a campaign contribution. Think about that.
Or campaign spending.
Yeah.
That you have to account for.
So the campaign spending then has to be recorded and accounted. And if not, then you violated a law. I guess that, okay, gotcha. Yeah, that may be gotcha, but that's not going to get you a different president. You know, I just don't think that changes things much. I mean, really, if the people who voted for the president don't care about some of the things he's said and done, I can't imagine that a campaign spending notation of $130,000 is going to change anybody's views about this presidency.
Well, I don't know how long you talk about it or keep talking about it or, you know, rehashing it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about that. But if it's true that a president paid $130,000 in hush money to a porn star, that's a story.
Yeah, it is.
Or you might not like it, but I mean,
well, I love it. but I got to figure out what box to put it in. And, you know, the incessant questioning about it, I don't know what.
Well, that's the thing. So you could report it. And, you know, the lawyer spoke, what was it, yesterday, the day before?
Yeah.
So report on what the lawyer said. And then after that, then it's just chatter on TV.
I kind of think it is. And listen, I don't know that I blame the chattering heads on TV.
They're chatter channels. That's what they are.
You're listening to a chatter show. And right. It's irresistible. I mean, because it's just so flippin' fantastic to think that this is what's happening and that's what we're talking about. But is it going to change anything? No, it's not. So I think we would all be better served if they would pursue with the same zeal, I don't know, DACA or taxes. I don't know what they're supposed to be reporting about. I suppose if one station was doing all my boring, serious stuff and the other one was doing the porn star, guess who's going to get better ratings?
Well, I mean, I'm watching the screens today and it's all about tariffs and things like that.
Yeah, so. It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is, I guess.
And what Stormy Daniels thinks of the tariffs.
Yeah.
She's opposed to them, by the way.
A friend of mine sent me, I could probably pull it up here if I don't use this friend's name, but he sent me a text. He said that here it is, stand by, says daughter had CNN on this morning. stepped into the kitchen and quickly returned as her three-year-old daughter, who recently has changed her career path from doctor to princess, was urgently shouting, "Mommy, Mommy, come look. Look, Mommy," pointing to the screen. "Look at the princess. Isn't she beautiful?" It was Stormy Daniels that was on TV. And the three-year-old was so thrilled to see a princess because whenever Stormy's on TV, she's just all glittery and pretty, you know. I mean, you know how she's always looking on TV. Little girl thought that's a princess. Oh, it's not a princess, honey. It's Stormy Daniels.
And a lot of guys might have called her a princess, too.
Yeah. And, you know, you read into that suit, and it's just, you know, it's a page-turner. But I'm not exactly sure where the needle on this thing needs to be, has been my point.
You crack me up, though. So you've read the suit?
Yeah.
Right. So you... You're way more into it than anyone I know.
Yeah. Well, I'm a talk show host. It's a career thing.
I loved your promo.
I know. I'm so staking out the moral high ground, right? This is an outrage. This is a personal matter between the president and his wife, and we are going to cover it all day long. Hypocrite. Danny, what did you want to say? You're on WGN. Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Hey.
No, really. Who really cares what he did before he became president? I mean, he was a playboy. That's what he did. It's between him and his wife, and it's his money. I mean, it's not like he took money from anybody. He made that money.
Well, technically, it looks like maybe he did. But
what's your point, Steve?
Well, there's also talk that he didn't. That the lawyer put the money up, and he hasn't paid the lawyer back.
Yeah, you got to pay the lawyer. I mean,
So it's not even his money.
I don't know that there was an obligation to do so. I want to have a friend so good and so rich that when I get myself into $130,000 worth of trouble, he goes, "Hey, John, I got this. I got it. Don't worry." Like the way you and I would pick up a drink at a bar. The president evidently had a friend who was going to pick up this problem for him and make it go away for $130,000.
Yeah, I do think the issue isn't, because, you know, look, he wrote in his books about being a philanderer, so that's not a big revelation.
You're making my point, Steve.
Well, but I think the difference is one of the central questions to him when if Russia and all that is, do they have something over him that they might be able to blackmail? And here you seem to have a case of him being willing to pay hush money to someone who did have something in the weeks before the election. So I think that's what makes it different from, you know, your run-of-the-mill porn star affair.
Yeah, well, if this was coming out in the dossier, then I might be more interested. But this just strikes me as very bad behavior from somebody who was very rich and used to live that kind of a lifestyle, and it's not our business. It's Melania's business. My God. I don't know what kind of media she consumes, but good grief, how humiliating this must be every single day. I don't know. You know, I literally wonder sometimes what the lives of people are like. Do they not read the newspaper? Do they not click around on the internet? Even Fox News is covering this. I wonder how you constantly endure that insult every single day, because every single day this is an insult to her and her kids.
She, I'm pretty sure, married a man who wrote in his books about how he played around on his wives.
Yeah. Who also met her while married at a party.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so...
So we can't. You're putting her in a traditional wife role.
I guess I
and
am
assuming her reaction. We don't have any idea how she's really reacting.
Well, I'll bet she doesn't like it. I mean, maybe she's not surprised, but don't you think she says, "Donald"? That was my Melania, by the way. You know, XYZ. I don't know what she says, but I mean, good grief! Like, how do you then sit down to dinner together or whatever?
Maybe they don't. Yeah. Maybe they haven't for a while.
Also, I think in a world where it is the norm, people know how to deal with it differently. If you've grown up in a household where it's hush-hush, you know, dad's doing this, mom, you know.
Everybody look the other way.
Yeah, and you keep the peace.
Gonna go get the papers.
Yeah. I got it, Mom. Here's the arts and entertainment section. You read the sports page. We'll take the front page and the business. And by the way, it's probably in the arts and entertainment section, too. I mean, it's just everywhere. Okay, Jack, you're on line 5. You're on WGN.
Yeah,
Jack?
I think this is an example, and I'm not sure. I'm going to start out by saying I don't know who's right or who's wrong, but I do know this, you know, that Fox News and other people of their ilk are terribly unscrupulous in that when Bill Clinton was faced with this problem, it was something they talked about every single day. And, I mean, at that point, my thoughts were, well, if it doesn't affect his presidency, that's between him and his wife.
Yeah.
But when the shoe's on the other foot, or the other, when Gary Hart did it, who was a liberal, that made big press and the conservative commentators. And, I mean, what irks me is, the liberals shouldn't do it and the conservatives should do it. I mean, they should be fair, fair and unbiased. I think that's what Fox says, they're fair and unbiased, but that's hardly the case.
I have not seen the publication. Well, I look at MSNBC, CNN, Fox, and Drudge. You know, that's kind of my big four there, if I'm just looking for left, right, left, right, left, right. And I haven't seen one that I thought was getting it right, putting it in the perspective that I would ask them to put it in. But I guess it's a very personal thing, right? You got 300 million people in this country, and there's probably 300 million different answers to what box should this go in? How important is this? How should we cover it? Paul Harvey, news and comment. Paul Harvey on this radio station years ago. Jack, thank you for the call. When Bill Clinton was president, when the Monica Lewinsky thing was going down, I forget what the military conflict was that we would have been involved in then. Steve, do you know what we would have been doing?
The Balkans, maybe?
Yeah. Pick one. Say it was the Balkans. But Paul
there
Harvey,
weren't that many.
Well, Paul Harvey labeled it Monica's War.
Oh.
He called it Monica's War. And his rationale was, his commentary was, that whatever it was that we were doing at the time was Bill Clinton's distraction from the impeachment and the affair. And I sure didn't agree with that. But I guess that's how these things can matter, too, right?
I wonder what he would say today.
Oh, my gosh. There have been people who have come and gone, and you wonder how would... You know, the voices that I think would be very interesting to hear right now are Jon Stewart's, are David Letterman's, are Bill O'Reilly's, are Bob Collins, are Paul Harvey's. You know, some interesting people who are alive or not, but generally are on the sidelines on these sorts of issues these days. It's 2:20 on WGN. President Trump is poised to raise the steel tariffs. And I heard something very interesting about that today, too. You know, I mean, who among us understands trade and steel and tariffs and economics? And Senator Ben Sasse was on CBS this morning, and I thought just gave such interesting and simple answers. He's a Republican lawmaker from Nebraska, and I thought he was really good. I'm going to play just a couple short segments of his answers for you in a few minutes on WGN. By the way, Jeannie Ives is going to be on our show tomorrow. Jeannie Ives will be joining us. I want to ask her a couple of questions, you know, about running for governor and some of the ads she's run. And specifically, how does she feel about the City Key program, which we've talked about a bit on this show?
Yes.
The City Key is the little card you get, and it gets you into the library and on public transportation. You can use it to vote.
You can't use it to vote.
You can use it to register to vote.
You can use it to register to vote. Why? Because it's got your name and address on it, right?
That's all that is required by federal law.
So by those standards, ComEd should stop sending illegals electric bills.
I think that's part of the conversation that they're not having.
But this is the same thing, right?
It is. The way I read it, Steve, and I've been talking to a lot of people on this at the Election Commission and at the City...
Board of Elections?
Yeah. But also Valencia's office has been talking to me, too, about this. And I think that there's a fix that's real simple for this, but they didn't call. We'll talk about that with Jeannie Ives on the show tomorrow. It should be a good conversation.
That friend of Mike Madigan's.
I know. And really...
We're picking on Mike Madigan again.
I know.
Now we're picking on Mike Madigan again.
Poor Mike Madigan.
I'd love to hear her response to that ad, too.
That was rated a liar, liar, pants on fire, because that sentence was so out of context that it's like saying up is down, says PolitiFact. You got a sweet tooth? Chicago's Best has decadent, delicious chocolate heading your way. It's an all-new Chicago's Best chocolate this Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Speaking of good things to eat, real quick, can I just insert this? You know, the Garrett's popcorn people that make the Chicago mix and all that stuff? Garrett's with the cheddar cheese popcorn and the caramel corn and the regular corn.
Mm.
Isn't that good stuff? So for the March Madness, for the basketball tournament, they are coming out with a bacon cheddar cheese popcorn. A bacon, I think maple cheddar popcorn. I sent them a note yesterday and said, you must bring a barrel to WGN. And they said, okay. They said yes. So I think we're going to get to sample that tomorrow.
Should have been today for Women's Day.
Why?
What does that have to do with Women's Day?
I don't know. I just wish that someone would have dropped something off.
I should have told them. And as you know, it's Women's Day. It'll be conspicuous if you don't have it here for Women's Day.
The heck with them.
I'll take it tomorrow. I'll take it tomorrow. By the way.
So will I.
Amen. I love me some of that. You looking to purchase a new home? You need to call Team Hochberg. Here's a story of Fred. Informed by his bank's mortgage expert that his 540, he had a 540 score, prohibited from purchasing a home for at least a year. His credit wasn't that good. He's dejected. Fred contacts Team Hochberg. He says, what am I going to do? He should have probably called Team Hochberg in the first place because Team Hochberg introduced Fred to their credit enhancement expert. They have a guy named Gary Novel over there, and he was able to get that credit score for Fred from 540 to 615. And at 615, he was able to borrow the money and buy the home. If you are credit challenged and you want to borrow, I want you to call Team Hochberg at Pearl Mortgage to take advantage of this amazing opportunity. Call Team Hochberg at 312-751-1333. That's 312-751-1333. Team Hochberg's helped thousands of GN listeners, but they can't help you if you don't call. Or visit WGNDavid.com. Pearl Mortgage is an equal housing lender and an Illinois residential mortgage licensee, 4358. The NMLS ID number is 19186. Nettie, on line 11, you're on WGN. This is John. What can I do for you?
Hi, John. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
I was just wondering what Mike Pence and the evangelicals and everybody with the family values think about this. And, you know, to answer the guy that called before who said, what's the difference? It happened before he's president. It's called he's lying about it. That's the difference. And he's our president.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he continues to say that it didn't happen. I wasn't there. But it sure looks like it happened. Well, why do you pay $130,000 to somebody if it didn't happen? He's saying it didn't happen. He's saying it didn't.
He doesn't know anything about the money, right?
So how do the Pences feel about that? I don't know. That's another person. I wonder about the lives of people. I'm telling you, I want to know what Mrs. Pence says to Mr. Pence about this stuff sometimes.
Isn't it funny how I laughed at, the vice president's policy of never going to a meeting alone with a woman.
Yeah, right.
You know, that was, 18 months ago?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that makes him look like a genius. Or maybe he is a genius. I don't know.
I don't know. But, you know, that thing kind of boomeranged on him, too, because what that ends up doing then is excluding women from equal access, right? The guys can go
out. I know, but we're a lot closer to that today than we were when we first learned about him doing it.
What do you think Mrs. Pence says to Mr. Pence? Does she say, Mike, for God's sakes, take that look off your face when you're looking at him? Or you need to speak out. You need to say something like, as a family values vice president, I'm embarrassed by this unseemly story. But he doesn't do that. I'll bet she feels that way. I'll bet she
there you go again.
Way. I think I know.
Maybe they're sitting together saying, okay, I think maybe just 9 more months. 9 more.
We are this close. We're listening in on the White House signing ceremony. The president is going to famously ink that trade tariff order of his.
Sounds like here he comes. The president flanked by advisors. Not Gary Cohn, by the way, is not there. Steve Mnuchin and others.
Some steelworkers with shiny steelworker helmets,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are, yes. President walking in between them and to the podium where he will talk about this steel and aluminum tariff and perhaps the exemptions for Canada and Mexico. Before he does so, though, he is making his way over to the steelworkers and other factory workers and talking to them.
I'm honored to be here with our incredible steel and aluminum workers. And you are truly the backbone of America. You know that. very special people. I've known you and people that are very closely related to you for a long time. You know that. I think it's probably the reason I'm here. So I want to thank you. I also want to thank Secretary Mnuchin, Ambassador Lighthizer, Secretary Ross, Peter Navarro, Mike Pence, our great vice president. They've worked so hard on getting this going and getting it done, and people are starting to realize how important it is. We have to protect and build our steel and aluminum industries, while at the same time showing great flexibility and cooperation toward those that are really friends of ours, both on a trade basis and a military basis. A strong steel and aluminum industry are vital to our national security, absolutely vital. Steel is steel. You don't have steel, you don't have a country. Our industries have been targeted for years and years, decades, in fact, by unfair foreign trade practices leading to the shuttered plants and mills, the laying off of millions of workers, and the decimation of entire communities. And that's going to stop, right? It's going to stop. This is not merely an economic disaster, but it's a security disaster. We want to build our ships. We want to build our planes. We want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem. It's a travesty. Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum. We will have a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on foreign aluminum when the product comes across our borders. It's a process called dumping, and they dumped more than at any time, on any nation, anywhere in the world. And it drove our plants out of business. It drove our factories out of business. And we want a lot of steel coming into our country, but we want it to be fair, and we want our workers to be protected, and we want, frankly, our companies to be protected. By contrast, we will not place any new tax on product made in the USA. So there's no tax if a product is made in the USA. You don't want to pay tax? Bring your plant to the USA. There's no tax, which we will benefit from the massive tax cuts that we have in place. We have passed the largest tax cut plan in the country's history, and that has caused really tremendous success between that and regulation cutting, and I think maybe regulation cutting every bit as much, and we have a long way to go on regulations, but we've already cut more than any president in history. So we're urging all companies to buy American. That's what we want, buy American. The action that I'm taking today follows a nine-month investigation by the Department of Commerce, Secretary Ross, documenting a growing crisis in our steel and aluminum production that threatens the security of our nation and also is bad for us economically and with jobs. The American steel aluminum industry has been ravaged by aggressive foreign trade practices. It's really an assault on our country. It's been an assault. They know better than anybody. Other countries have added production capacity that far exceeds demand and flooded the world market with cheap metal that is subsidized by foreign governments, creating jobs for their country and taking away jobs from our country. I've been talking about this for a long time, a lot longer than my political career. I've been talking about this for many years. For example, it takes China about 1 month to produce as much steel as they produce in the United States in an entire year, because we've closed down so much capacity. Plants closed all over the United States, and some plants I see, massive plants from 40 years ago, and they're working now in a little corner of the building. Well, we're going to get those buildings open again and producing again, and that's going to be a great thing for our country. And this is only the first stop. Aluminum imports now account for more than 90% of the primary American demand. Over the last two decades, nearly two-thirds of American raw steel companies have gone out of business. More than one-third of the steel jobs have disappeared. Six primary aluminum smelters, which is a big deal, have permanently shut down since just 2012. The actions we're taking today are not a matter of choice. They're a matter of necessity for our security. We're already seeing the national security benefits of this order. Yesterday, in anticipation that we'd be here today, U.S. Steel announced it's reopening a mill in Illinois, a big one, and recalling 500 workers immediately. That's going on all over the country. And by the way, it went on with solar panels, which we did 3 months ago, and washing machines, where they were dumping washing machines all over our country. And now they're expanding plants to make washing machines. We put the tax on. A lot of you are here. A skilled, trained workforce in steel is a crucial element of America's national security and must be protected. After the signing of this proclamation, Century Aluminum in Kentucky, Century is a great company, will be investing over $100 million to restart and upgrade their idled military-grade, high-quality aluminum production, which is also critically important to our national security. That's 150,000 additional tons of aluminum. And think of it. This is a closed plant, and now they're doing 150,000 tons. Production and an additional 300 workers, and ultimately many more hired in the great state of Kentucky. A package of sometimes $90,000 per worker. Our greatest presidents all understood, from Washington to Lincoln to Jackson to Teddy Roosevelt, that America must have a strong, vibrant, and independent manufacturing base. Has to have it. President McKinley, who felt very, very strongly about this, the country was very, very successful. We actually operated out of cash flow, if you can believe it. The protective tariff policy of the Republicans, he said, has made the lives of masses of our countrymen sweeter and brighter and brighter and brighter.
President Trump at the White House, flanked by the vice president, members of his economic team, and then some steel workers who are standing around there.
And aluminum workers.
And aluminum workers, too. That typing sound you hear in the background is the fact checkers who will almost certainly quibble with some of his statistics there. By the way, U.S. steel companies were profitable this year, more profitable than the year before and more profitable than the year before that. They are not losing money. They are making money. But the president wants the playing field to be fairer, he says. And so, and another thing that I frequently hear him cite in this and other speeches or commentary that he's made is that it's for our national defense. I believe that's actually what enables the president to do this, right?
Right. Steve? They can invoke national defense. Now, the fact is the military is not a very big steel customer.
Right.
But, so it's a bit of a stretch.
Well, but that's what you do. You say, right. I have to do this for the national defense, and therefore I can do this extraordinary order. That's why you give the president this power.
I want to change, you know, in the Britain and Ireland, they refer to it's aluminium. I think we should change that. It sounds so much better than aluminum.
Does it sound fancier?
Aluminium.
It's not. We don't just have aluminum. We have aluminium.
So I've been watching Wall Street here on the president's announcement, and the Dow was up, I don't know, about 60 points or so as he started, and then it dropped into negative territory quite a bit. It's recovering now. I don't know if you read anything into that. I mean, pretty much.
I don't know.
We got what we expected.
Well,
right?
He's carving
for a
out
long
Mexico,
time this was coming.
But so. He's carving out Mexico. Right. I think the market's factored in a lot of this anyway. And on the upside, he's carving out Mexico. He's carving out Canada. He's carving out other countries that will do favorable pacts or treaties with us for defense. So it sounds like he's going to use these tariffs as a lever, you know, as opposed to an all-out trade war. I don't know. Maybe I have a minute here. It's 2:48. We'll pause and come back. Ben Sasse, the Republican from Nebraska, a Republican, has a different view on this. And what he said this morning, I thought was helpful. We'll hear what he had to say in a minute on WGN.
Hi, it's Steve Bertrand. I'm talking with Andy Smith, Senior Vice President of Financial Planning at Financial Engines. Andy, my friend, welcome back.
Steve, how you been?
Great. It's great to talk to you again. Well, I got a lot to talk about, right? I mean, we've had the volatility to start the year, the Dow down 150 points now. It was recovering a little bit earlier today, but we are living in volatile times, it seems like. What do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, you put these episodes in context, right? It's been about 5 months since the market had a 2% correction. It's been about 15 months since the market had a 3% correction. I mean, you got to go back like 19 or 20 months since the market had a 5% correction. So you look at the activity. I mean, 2017 was gangbusters. January was amazing. We saw a little bit of volatility here over the last couple of weeks, but you're supposed to get these types of drops, like 5% drops, 10% drops, even 15% drops, anywhere between 1 and 5 times a year.
If you're worried that you might start dropping down the charts, what should someone do? I mean, what do you advise people to do if they're concerned these days?
Yeah, the first thing I tell them is, look, stay focused, stay on track, remember what your goals are. You go back to your plan, don't do any of this panic buying or panic selling, because that's what's going to throw you off, you know, long term. You don't want to necessarily focus on the next 30 minutes. Your job is to focus on the next 30 years. So number one, stay focused. Number two, just check what you have. Check your allocation, right? How much you've got in stocks, bonds, and cash. Look at your investments. You know, some people, this is a time to invest more.
Where do we find you?
FinancialEngines.com. Got some great team members up there in the Chicagoland area, but FinancialEngines.com. Find time to talk with somebody. Get going on that plan today.
Andy Smith, great to talk to you. I hope we can do it again soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks, Andy. Again, that's FinancialEngines.com.
Life goes by too quickly to be in constant pain. And you may be thinking, well, that's just the way my life is now because I've got a bad knee, my knee hurts, and now I live a different lifestyle. It does not have to be that way. I want you to visit the Joint Relief Institute. It's where I went. It's where I'm going to go. Let's see. Today is, is it this Friday or next Friday? March 16th. It's next Friday that I do that dancing thing. I'm going to go over there next week and get another pain relief injection at the Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park. They use advanced digital technology to gently place a joint lubricant into the exact spot where your knee is bothering you. It's now, not surgery.
Can you get caught for doping for that, for this dance competition? Is that, no, doping with...
with a joint relief medication? I don't know.
You're getting a little extra. You might be a little lighter on your toes because of it.
John, you are really good. We're going to have to ask you to pee in this cup. We just want to take a look. And why am I using the voice of the man from Cat Spot?
You mean Jeff?
We just want you to give it a try.
Coconut.
That's all they'll find in me is coconut. And maybe some Joint Relief Institute juice. I don't know what the stuff is, but you go get that juice in your knee, Jack, and you'll be dancing like me. Here's the number to call. Boy, this is a really good commercial, isn't it? 708-888-0000. That's the Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park. 708 Orland Park, 888. You can remember that. 0000, as in zero pain. Ben Sasse is a Republican senator from Nebraska. He, in anticipation of what the president just did, you heard Donald Trump sign that executive order putting tariffs on aluminum and steel into this country. You just heard that here on WGN. Anticipating that, Ben Sasse, the Republican senator from Nebraska, was on CBS this morning. He talked about what it means, what he thinks about it, and trade imbalance.
These tariffs are a terrible idea. Tariffs always hurt us. Ultimately, nobody ever wins a trade war. Both sides lose a trade war. Trade is indisputably good for America. It's good for consumers on both sides of every trading relationship. And all of our trade deals have been on net good for America in terms of job creation.
Then how do you explain a trade deficit of nearly $1 billion, $800 million? President Trump tweeting yesterday that the U.S. has lost 55,000 factories, 6 million manufacturing jobs, and has this huge trade deficit.
A lot of times trade deficits on a bilateral basis are just completely misunderstood. I have a trade deficit with the grocery store. They supply a whole bunch of really good stuff that I want, and I give them my money, and that circulates back into the economy.
It's an interesting point. I mean, sure, we have a trade imbalance maybe with country X on steel or aluminum because they can make it less expensively than we can. We're able to buy it cheaper. Now we get well-made products at a discount. He says, but guess what? If we have a trade imbalance with them, that looks bad. But guess what they have? A trade imbalance with us on soybeans. And so if you just look at one thing and say, oh my God, this is terrible. There's a trade imbalance here. We need to put a tariff on there to fix that. It sort of forgets the fact that maybe we're able to grow food better and we export that. So now we have a trade surplus in some other area. And that's what commerce is. That's what trade is. Whoever can produce something at the best cost and make it best, that's where you should go to get it. That's just another view on it. It's Ben Sasse's view from Nebraska. So they asked him a little bit about jobs.
If you just look at steel, this plan will kill steel jobs in America. Why? How could that be? It sounds like you'd be doing this because you're trying to help steel workers. There are 140,000 production steel mill workers in America. There are more than 5 million factory workers in America that work at factories that use steel as a primary input. When you raise the price of steel, those factory workers are going to lose jobs. There are going to be some of those 140,000 steel production workers that will benefit. There'll be lots more of the 5 million steel workers that use them as inputs that are going to suffer. We need to start telling the American people the truth about what's happening in big factory jobs. And the analog is agriculture. In 1900, more than 40% of Americans worked on farms. 100 years later, less than 2%, and yet we produce more stuff. That's what's happening in industrial factory jobs right now.
He was on a roll. You heard Nora Roberts getting ready to insert a question or a comment, but he had a few things he wanted to say. And at the end, I won't take the time to play it here, but while he said, I'm very critical of this decision, I had a robust and honest conversation with the president, and he wasn't just dumping on Trump because he doesn't like Trump. This is Ben Sasse from Nebraska. He said, but I vehemently disagree with him on this policy, and that's what I'm here to tell you. And he minced no words. Sasse was pretty good this morning. It's 2:56. Ro and Anna will be pretty good this afternoon. They'll pop into the studio next. Ro Khan just strolled into the studio. Hi, Ro Khan.
I did indeed, John. That's all I'm doing today is strolling.
How are you?
I'm strolling. I just got back from the White House where I was at the press conference. That's how quickly I move.
Wow.
With the steel workers and aluminum workers. He got a full 10 guys in hard hats to stand behind him in the White House and say that this is all good for America.
Yeah.
As he signs the tariffs. And the market doesn't seem to be reacting. So
maybe the market already did, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, there was more dire predictions from analysts that it would be more intense. But we'll talk to Serena Marshall, who's there at the White House, coming up in just a few minutes here to talk about what does this actually mean for America.
I think the market right now is flat. I think we're going to close the day about even.
It's what it looks like, yeah.
So
I mean, there was
that.
Some concern that...
Yeah,
that once he signed this, because people didn't. I mean, one of the reasons they were speculating the market didn't go down further is people didn't believe this was actually going to happen. Now there will be some carve outs here, and we're going to get details on Canada and
Mexico
because you know those are gigantic trading partners with the United States.
Well, that's the thing. So maybe he gets to have his cake and eat it. He says, "Okay, I stood up for the steelworkers," mm-hmm. and then does all these side deals that kind of guts the teeth of the thing anyway. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
So, and I'd be okay with that. Listen, if the market doesn't go to the crapper and the steel workers are happy and they open up a new aluminum. I was almost said aluminium. Aluminum. Bertrand wants us to say aluminium.
Yes, because I know it's very, very popular now, I guess, with the British or something. Yeah, I suppose.
All right, well, I'll get out of your way, Roque.
All right.
Have a good show.